I'm Frances Lefcourt, and I'm in the Department of Cell Biology and Neuroscience. When I think of the brain, I think about the fact that the brain is made up of over 100 billion cells that are called neurons, okay? And these neurons have a very important shape that allows them to function and to do all the processes we all described here. So, for example, they have one end of the neuron is receiving information, and the other end of the neuron is transmitting information. And how your brain works, how it accomplishes all these tasks we've listed, is by this intensive intercommunication between all these neurons. So a single neuron can communicate with 10,000 other neurons in the brain via all these connections. Okay? And the way they do that is by releasing small molecules, chemicals, that are called neurotransmitters. And if that balance of chemical transmission is awry, either too much or too little, then problems can start to develop in the brain. So the other key point I want to make about the brain is it's part of a nervous system. And that nervous system is composed of the central nervous system, which is the brain and spinal cord. But you also have this vast peripheral nervous system. And the peripheral nervous system, a lot of people think it's just, oh, those nerves out there. So I take offense when I hear that, because it's not just nerves. They're actually, it's full of nerve cells, neurons, okay? And these neurons, there's millions of them, and they're organized and arranged in discrete places in your body. So you have a bunch of them on either side of your spinal cord, and those are the cells that mediate, like when you touch the stove and it's hot and you yell, that's through those sensory neurons. You also have neurons that regulate your blood pressure, respiration, kidney function, that's your autonomic nervous system. Those neurons are also part of the peripheral nervous system. And then lastly, you have a big collection of neurons in your neck, and that's called the vagus. And that ganglion, so a ganglion is a collection of neurons, that collection of neurons is outside of your central nervous system, but they are key players for everything we're going to talk about today. And so neurons in this vagus ganglion travel all the way. They travel to your kidney, to your liver, to your gut, and to your heart. And if there's anything wrong with activity in the vagus ganglion, you can start to have imbalance between the gut and the brain. And then the last part of the nervous system that we care deeply about is what is called the second brain. And that's in your gut. So it turns out you have over 100 million neurons in your gut. Okay? And they're just like the neurons in the brain in that they're very interconnected. They're communicating with hundreds of other neurons. And they're also, what we're going to be talking about, they're connected to your brain via this vagus ganglion. So whatever is going on in your gut has a direct conduit to the brain, and whatever's going on in your brain has a direct conduit to your gut. And that's it. Now we're going to, Valerie Copier is going to talk about metabolism.
So you're going to say, fine, so the neurons are the bosses, and so why is Sepha not here? Well,
they might ask that after.
Yeah, okay. All right. Well, I'll tell you why we're here. It's because Frances is a super good friend, and she had some super great ideas, and we had to go with this. So anyway, that's the answer for that. But my question to you guys is, so I'm the boring biochemist, so when you think of metabolism, what do you think?
How many of you worry about what you eat for breakfast? Yeah. All right. Why do you care about that? Because, you know, I'll tell you what, I hate breakfast. I'm not a morning person. And when I have breakfast, I fall asleep. Because I eat something, and what happens? Fall asleep. But you guys don't. You get your energy out of it, right? So most of us would think about protein, carbohydrates, and fat. You're not going to say, hey, and you know, if you say, well, too much carbohydrates, that's not good for you. Let's go for a ketogenic diet. Or let's just go on the, supposedly mice, when they starve, that means they don't get energy, they live longer. Okay, fine, but living longer, but you don't have energy, quality of life. No good, all right? Okay, so. All right, so here's what, when I think of metabolism, I think of little molecules. I think of stars in the universe. I think of them moving around, and half the time I have no idea what they're doing. I know that they're there to generate energy. I know some of them are there to make building blocks, like proteins and cell membranes and all that. But actually what we're finding is that these little molecules, you know, they're like little toddlers. They've got tricks in the back of their pocket. You know, they do things you would never imagine. So I'll give you an example. What we found is metabolites, these small molecules that Francis and Seth and I will talk about in some more, it turns out that they play tricks. They play tricks on neurons. They may be the microbes produce their own little metabolites that can play tricks on us. And the other thing they do is they can say, hey, you're a gene, you want to express a protein, well, tough luck. You're going to be silenced. Like, I have a couple students from my lab here, and I'm going to say, okay, Colin, can't say a word, because my little metabolite is telling you can't say a word. So we have what we call epigenetic events that are actually modulated by many things, but one of them is metabolites. So that's really different from the idea of, oh my God, metabolites, that they are used for energy, we need them for being able to move in the morning. They are also doing things that are really strange. And we're just starting to realize there's a huge connection between neurons and the microbiome. So now, we really do that.
My specialty, or the area that we focus on in my lab, is the human microbiome. So define, what do you think of when you think of the gut and the microbiome? Oftentimes we think of the gut, we think of that maybe leftover food that we had that's not so good anymore, or a quick trip to the bathroom because of urgency. You know, symptoms, things that make us sick. Well, it turns out that some of the reasons that we feel those things is exactly why we're here. The nerves that innervate our gut signal many things to our brain, and we're just at the cutting edge of figuring out what those things are. So a little bit more on the microbes. The microbiome, defined by a nerd, is anything, any microorganism living in us and on us. Okay, so it turns out that we are not alone in our journey through the world, that we are covered literally in microbes. And they live in us, but also on our skin, and they can be with us for a very long time. Most folks are colonized at birth from mom or their environment, but we quickly become colonized. These microbes start to talk to each other and talk to us, and over time they develop very complex networks. Metabolic networks, signaling molecules are involved, and this diversity helps us do what we do every day. For example, if you eat food, which all of us do, that food is first operated on by our cells. That food is broken down, giving us energy, helping our metabolism. But then the leftovers go to the microbes, and then they get their chance. And things called secondary metabolites that they make are very, very important for human health. They make molecules that actually educate our immune systems. 70% of our immune system is gut-associated, meaning it lives in our gut, just to throw some stats out there for you. But the other thing is that we often don't talk about in the microbiome is how we developed symbioses. So we actually live together with these things. And this is important because I'm an ecologist. And that's it. No, because ecology tries to explain things, right? So ecology tries to look out in the forest and say, why are elk there? Why are moose there? what are the predators, you know, understand those dynamics. Ecology is about understanding the relationships between organisms. And as a gut microbial ecologist, we do the same thing. Symbiosis, living together, means that we have some kind of relationship with our microorganisms. The question now is, what is that relationship? Who has heard of commensal? Okay, commensalism is a type of symbiosis in which there are two partners. One provides the other with benefit, often we think of food, but the other partner doesn't do anything. It's just sort of along for the ride. So for about 150 years, we've been calling our gut microbes commensals. We provide the food and they just kind of take up space. Now what we're understanding is that it's not a commensalism, it's a mutualism, whereby both partners benefit each other. How the bugs are benefiting us is really what we try to understand, and I think why we're integrating all these ideas together. Okay, so that's the three parts, and now back to Francis.
Okay, great. So you know all the players. So now imagine, construct a triangle, and what we're really interested in is this interaction between those three players. So the interaction between neurons, the microbiome in the gut, and the metabolism, and how all these different players are affecting each other and affecting our health, and how this how these interactions can go awry to cause disease. So this field, this interaction between these players, especially between the gut microbiome and the nervous system, is called the gut-brain axis. And this field has kind of exploded on the scene just really in the last 15 years. And there have been so many, I've seen figures where if you look at the rate of publications in this field, it's you know, almost this exponential curve over the last 10 years. So there's every year there's more and more data being accumulated showing strong interactions between the nervous system and the gut microbiome. And so, you know, all those things we say all the time, you know, it's in my gut, I feel it, I have a gut instinct, you know, you're nervous and you have stomach cramps. I mean, it's real, it's real. And so in terms of now, if you start to think, okay, at a cellular level or at a molecular level, what does that really mean? Okay, so imagine, now try to imagine you're inside the lumen of your intestine, okay? So you're in the intestine, and the intestine, the walls of the intestine are lined with cells. And those cells are called intestinal epithelial cells. So you've got an epithelium, which is just a sheet of cells. And if the connections between those epithelial cells break down, you get leaky gut. So it's very important that that epithelium maintain itself as a barrier, okay? So it turns out, so if you're inside this lumen and you've got these gut epithelial cells that need to be tightly associated with each other, now imagine bring in the trillions of bacteria that are in your gut, and they're interacting with those gut epithelial cells. And what we've discovered in the last 10 years, really, is that there are tremendous numbers of neurons with those extensions that I mentioned before that actually communicate directly, are physically adjacent to those gut epithelial cells, and actually have connections with those gut epithelial cells. Even when we talk about the brain, when two neurons are connected, we call that a synapse. They actually, we now find synapses between neurons in the gut with those gut epithelial cells. Okay, and imagine the bacteria are just on the other side of those connections. And now imagine, and you don't even, it's true, you don't have to imagine, the bacteria are making neurotransmitters that bind to the neurons. Okay? So if you think of a famous neurotransmitter many of you might know about, for example, serotonin, It's the major neurotransmitter involved in mood, and a major class of antidepressants, their job is to elevate levels of serotonin. Well, it turns out 70% of your serotonin is made in your gut, and it's made by those gut epithelial cells and the bacteria, not by the neurons. Okay?
Can I add something?
Sure.
And the other thing you want to know is, so when you eat, okay, you have glucose, but at some point you deplete your energy and you need to make more glucose. So your liver, which is my favorite organ, makes glucose, but actually your gut makes a lot more than your liver.
Yeah.
So one more thing on this, and I think I was supposed to mention this earlier, but I've forgotten. There's only a single cell layer called the epithelium that separates us from the outside world in your gut, right? So your gut is a tube, right? It's the same as your skin, but it's a tube inside. If you would stretch that tube out, and the surface area would be about the size of a badminton court, and that is a horrible analogy because nobody plays badminton. But it's about 350 square feet. So to put that in perspective, when I was dating my lovely wife, she lived in a 700 square foot apartment, and so the two of us made up that whole thing. All right? Okay, so that's one thing I forgot to mention, but the thing about the neurotransmitters that we're just starting to understand is the metabolites that are involved, we thought did something totally different. For example, E. coli, everybody has heard of E. coli probably, right? The most studied organism on the planet makes a neurotransmitter called GABA, and it does so to avoid or get away from acid. It's a byproduct of decarboxylating an amino acid to take up a proton, which makes acid. Okay, so it does something totally different, but in the process, it makes a neurotransmitter. Okay, so if you can pause there and sort of say, well, you know, we anthropomorphize microbes all the time, but E. coli don't have a brain, right? We are the ones that have a brain. But they're doing something that helps us. So the question then is, why are they helping us, and what happens when they don't help us? Right? Because they're not going to think about it, they're just going to do what they do. And that's maybe another good example of the neurotransmitter.
Yeah, and actually GABA is the most important inhibitory neurotransmitter in your brain. And so if GABA levels are too low, for example, you can have epileptic seizures. Things like benzodiazepines, Valium, work by increasing GABA levels. So again, you know, you see, this is very recent that we're appreciating that these critical neurotransmitters are not only being made in the brain, but they're being made in the gut. And the question is, does that gut production of neurotransmitter, to what extent does it affect our mood, our cognitive function, the state of activity?
Francis explained to you what the vagus nerve was. It took me like 2 years. I'm still not sure I understood what. And then I said, Francis, we need to look at the liver. She looked at me like, I've been telling you this is a neurodegenerative disease. I said, I know, but it's impacting the liver. She said, okay, if you say so. And you know what? That's learning the language.
So the question was your appendix and whether it plays a role or not in your microbiome. So that's a great question. So there are studies out there suggesting that our appendix is not necessarily worthless, as we've been told, especially when you have your appendix out. So there's an idea that there are some vestiges of microbes that are stored in your appendix, and that help repopulate the distal gut whenever it becomes depauperate, say by antibiotics or some other treatment. And I think there are some pretty good studies on that, suggesting that, and I don't see why it couldn't be. Whether that's the case for all of us, I'm not sure. And when you have your appendix out, it doesn't seem to affect your ability to rebound from those kind of things. So there are only four ways to treat the microbiome that we have right now. Antibiotics, which are do amazing things, bring you back from your deathbed, but they also do other things that we're understanding are not healthy. You have fecal microbiome transplants, so literally what it sounds, and
it's
literally,
not as bad as you think.
No, it's as bad as you think. There's, yeah.
All right.
It's pretty, but it's an ancient technique that's been shown to work. It was in the 15th century Chinese medical journals about its effectiveness for some types of illness. And I don't know how else, how you define a proven therapy, but that seems to stick. So there's antibiotics, there's fecal microbiome transplant, there's prebiotics, meaning you take something that a particular microbe likes and therefore blooms, or a probiotic, which is a live microorganism that you take to then develop in your gut and give you a benefit. Okay, four things currently that we have. FDA does not regulate probiotics. Okay, so let's start there in the conversation. The point of FDA is to regulate investigational new drugs that are presented to society to cure a disease. They're based on fact in a number of clinical trials. They're ordered, clinical trial level 1, 2, 3. But FDA doesn't regulate probiotics, so there aren't these scientific studies that often support them. So in the absence of information, there is opinion, okay? So there's many opinions out there, and what we know as fact, as scientists, is that probiotics will probably not hurt you, okay? So have at it. If you feel benefit, it could be the probiotic. It could also be a placebo effect. And we just don't have the information in, under a lot of context to say supportively whether which one is happening. What I can say as a microbial ecologist is this. If I took, and this is not a microbial analogy, but if I took seeds of grass that are used to seed a golf course, and I go up to highlight and throw those out in a mature forest, I will not come back next year and golf there. Okay? The seeds that I throw out there hit a complex community that there is no niche for grass. Okay? The same is true with a lot of probiotics. I don't know which ones. We don't study, you know, what's out there, but we are trying to develop, the field is trying to develop things that when you do throw it out in a system that we want to change, that they will establish and help us. But that information is forthcoming. Is that understandable?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yogurt.
Yogurt's good, but lactobacillus are pretty much gone at the rate of gut transit. So the plating studies that have been done, now again, there's a lot of other things in yogurt, right? There's sugars and I don't know what else is
calcium.
There. There's calcium,
yes.
Right. Calcium is great, right?
You see,
in moderation.
We should have 3 years of lab meetings before we present to each other.
We're a work in progress if you haven't figured that out. But maybe we can talk a little bit more about the neurodegenerative diseases.
Okay, so why are we all here? And the reason we're here is, as soon as Seth arrived on campus and he was doing gut microbiome, as a neurobiologist, I was extremely excited because there was starting to come, all this information was starting to come out about autism, Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, and connections to the gut. So you might know, it's now becoming very clear that in the case of Parkinson's, the first symptoms a patient will manifest are gut problems, way before they have the motor problems. So there's something about the gut being either a trigger or the first manifestation of what will be a neurodegenerative disease. Similarly, you might know that there's a strong connection between autism and having gut problems, gut motility problems. Now, it gets complicated because a lot of times people with autism also have distinct food preferences and food aversions. So if you start thinking about the microbiome, you know, you could start to think that, well, geez, depending on what you eat, you know, that's really setting up a different ecosystem in your gut. So when Seth came, I wanted to talk about all these things. And then as time went on, we decided, I started working more on a particular neurodegenerative disease. And the disease I work on is called familial dysautonomia. It's a rare disease, it's a genetic disease, but it was a disease I cared about because I had grown up with two cousins who had this disease and they died of this disease. So we had started to make mouse models for this disease, and I was starting to notice these really striking similarities between the mice and the patients. So for example, the patients are extremely skinny. They have no fat on them whatsoever. And the mice are extremely skinny and have no fat on them whatsoever. So that got me talking to Valerie about why something's obviously different about their metabolism.
And they were eating, right?
They have a great appetite.
Right,
great, yeah. Yeah. So, and then things kept going. So it turns out the patients also have severe gut problems. So they have problems with gut motility. They have problems with gastroesophageal reflux. They have problems swallowing. Because of the problems swallowing, they tend to aspirate and they get lung infections, and so they're on antibiotics all the time. And so, you know, from conversations with Seth, I started wondering what's causing what? I mean, so between these metabolism issues that they clearly have, between these gut problems that they clearly have, I mean, the fact they're so frequently on antibiotics, what does their gut ecosystem look like? And how is that affecting their metabolism? And then how are those two things feeding back on the nervous system? And we know the nervous system is marked by neurodegeneration, that neurons are dying. And there was some data already showing that there were fewer neurons in the guts of the patients. So that's kind of where our work started, was, you know, to take this multi-pronged approach. We would look at the nervous system. My lab would look at the nervous system. Seth's lab would look at the gut microbiome. Valerie's lab would look at the metabolism. And the cool thing that we did is we are going back and forth between patients and mice. So it turns out at NYU, that's a center that sees all the people in North America with this disease. And so they can collect blood samples from all the patients, stool samples. And so we're collaborating with them. And so we have the ability to compare. So for example, the patients, right? They're on antibiotics all the time. Well, turns out our mice are not on antibiotics. But in one of the first experiments we did, we found that the gut microbiome was significantly different between the mutant mice and the control mice, and those mice didn't take antibiotics. So, and even more interestingly, the first 3 weeks, the mice are all raised together with their mom, and they're a mixture of mutants and controls. Their gut microbiome was indistinguishable from each other. But then if you separate the mutants from the controls, over a period of a couple months, the microbiome of the mutants and the controls diverges very, very strikingly. So right there, that's answering a question we couldn't answer in the patients, but we could answer in the mice, and it shows that in fact their gut microbiome is different without any antibiotics. So these are the kinds of experiments we're doing. Yeah, the question is, if we were to rehouse the mutants and the controls together, would their microbiomes equilibrate? We predict that yes, because in the past, whenever we looked at microbiomes, we didn't see differences between mutants and controls. So we predict yes, but we formally haven't done that experiment. But we'll tell you some even cooler experiments that we can do.
So the familial dysautonomia that Francis's lab is well known for, world-class researcher around the world. Why study this rare-ish disease in humans? And why are we so, why is the NIH, why, how do we sell this to the federal granting agency, and why are they giving us money to study this very rare disease? The point is that most neurodegenerative diseases, things like we're familiar with, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, these things are very complex genetically. Okay, so they're, we talk about complex diseases as those that have a genetic component, often an environmental component. Some of the environmental components can be chance events like gut infections or other types of events through the, through your life that lead to the onset of pathology and disease. Okay, so you can try to imagine 10 mutations in the genome that predispose you for things that are difficult to study anyway. The really interesting thing about familial dysautonomia is there's one mutation, or I'm sorry, there's
one,
probably
99% have the exact same mutation.
99% of the patients have the exact same mutation, but it's one, it's a very simple thing to wrap our heads around genetically, to try then to tease apart the environmental factors like the microbiome and metabolism that are important. So it's a very unique disease, but it, again, we think that what we discover here is going to be very applicable to these other types of diseases. Okay, so how do we study the microbiome? Francis was mentioning lab animals and patients. So we compare patients with a relative, cohabitating if possible, because we know that you share your poop with each other if you live together, and with your pets. So we looked at the patients and we found that they indeed were different than their relatives. And then we observed the mice that Francis's lab developed on campus with collaborators, but just very unique experimental models. And we looked at those mice and we found the same thing. So now what do we do? And this is where the project gets interesting, because we can raise mice germ-free, okay? And people have heard of germ-free animals. Anyone? You can raise a mouse completely sterile. You can raise, the first germ-free animal was a quail, right? The thing that makes an egg, you can sterilize the egg and hatch it in a sterile environment. Mammals are difficult, right? You have to bottle feed them to get them, so you can imagine bottle feeding a little mouse. But once you have a germ-free animal, you can establish other germ-frees by co-fostering. Okay, so we keep these things in hermetically sealed isolators and raise them their whole lives germ-free. Why is that important? Well, we can then take away the microbiome and ask, in the absence of all those microorganisms, all those interactions, what's the disease look like? And then we can add specific microbes back and say, does that protect? Does that exacerbate? Or the cool thing, sort of the state-of-the-art thing, is we're not really interested in the mouse microbiome, right? Mice microbes don't really interest us. But human microbiome does. And we can get the human microbiome from stool samples and establish that in germ-free animals. They're called notobiotic mice then. But those mice are, we're keenly aware of the differences that that microbiome makes, differences in the host, what impacts they have on the neurons, maybe what neurotransmitters that they're making, what metabolites they're making. So these are the some of the ways that we're going to go about this.
Can I add in the, so the precedent for this, why I think this is such an exciting experiment, there was a recent paper done with Parkinson's patients and mice. So they had mouse models for Parkinson's, and they had Parkinson patients' stool samples. And they could take the mice, and the mice were sort of predisposed to develop a Parkinson's-like syndrome, so they weren't perfectly normal mice. But they found if they gave the mice antibiotics, the mice did great. Their symptoms improved. They had fewer motor problems. But if they transplanted in Parkinson patient stool, then their symptoms got worse, okay? So that is a really elegant illustration of how the human gut microbiome can alter behavior. And so again, if you're thinking about this loop we're telling you about, or this triangle, I mean, all you're doing is you're transplanting in bacteria and you're altering, to get a change in motor output, you have to get signals then from the gut back up to the brain, to very specific regions of the brain, cause the motor output. So right there is just an incredibly powerful illustration of how important this communication is between the gut microbes and affecting neuronal activity in the brain.
So the question was the choline cleansing.
Yes.
And have there been temporal studies of perhaps the microbes that are in the gut? There are very few temporal microbiome studies, period. And the answer that I don't know of any, but there needs to be more temporal studies following the same individual over time and looking at dynamics. The vast majority of microbiome research is what we call cross-sectional, where you, at one point in time you sample a bunch of people and then compare those people. So we don't really understand temporal dynamics really well. Most of those temporal studies are done in children as the microbiome's developing. There's a lot of interest in how do we get the healthiest microbiome in kids the quickest. And in the context of neurodegenerative disease, ASD is a big one because it affects kids. The onset at least is diagnosed a lot in children. So we want to understand whether early events in the microbiome can decrease those disease rates. And piggybacking on something Francis said was the our human clinical trials that are ongoing for fecal transplants to treat symptoms, at least, maybe not the disease in general, but symptoms of neurodegenerative diseases. And there was a study out in 2017 on a cohort of autistic children with ASD, that had a GI symptom index that the clinicians scored. Half were placebo, half were microbiome fecal transplants, and the microbiome transplant group performed better. Their disease severity decreased. We don't know why, right? So when Valerie was talking about, she thinks about the stars in the sky, I mean, that's literally where we are right now. We're giving people poop and saying, does that help?
So another thing we've noticed in Francis's disease model is the neurons are dying because they're under energetic stress. So the metabolism is messed up. So again, we don't know what's causing what, but what we're thinking is that maybe we can use the microbiome, maybe do a microbiome intervention to try to redress the balance, the energetic balance. And if we do, what we're thinking is, okay, what happened to the neurons? Are they dying slower? Can we maybe, because neurons are very dynamic. Actually, the whole system is very dynamic. So maybe we can say, well, this was too much, I've got to die, but maybe you regenerate some of the neuronal connection. So the really amazing system that we have is with the germ-free mice, we can reintroduce specific microbes. Francis knows which neuron we should look at. She knows when they're sick, and she knows when they're healthy. And then I can say, okay, let's take this little molecule succinate and see what happens. Now, obviously, as Seth said, if I did that in a human, I said, why don't you take a succinate supplement, a 50-50 chance of making you feel better or worse. Let's not do that on a human. Let's see what happened with the mice first. So the idea of using a microbiome intervention to regenerate or maybe slow down the neurodegeneration is what's really exciting. And that's something where, again, I would have never thought of that because I'm not a neuroscientist. Lactobacillus, it was about my knowledge of a microbiome. And so it really takes that these different fields to come together to try to think about, okay, if we could minimize the energetic stress using microbes as our helpers, what happened to the neurons? And maybe we could say, no, actually, you're making it worse. Or so we don't know the answer, but whatever answer we're going to get, it's going to give us some insights. And that's the exciting part.
This bacteria is one of the most common causes of gingivitis. It's an anaerobe, actually, that lives in the mouth. And yes, you breathe oxygen, but there's anaerobic niches in your gums. And so the idea was that they did a large consortia study of many folks that had Alzheimer's, and they found this curious observation that a lot of them also had gum disease. And so they did some follow-on experiments to not only show a tight association between this bacterium and disease, but also the toxin that it makes. Then they had a molecule that could inactivate the toxin, and that helped in their mouse models. That molecule now is in clinical trials, fast-track clinical trials, to understand whether it is effective in humans. And the study that I read was I think almost exclusively done in industry, which is great, because that's a very, they're the ones that push new drug development. So I think it's exciting. I don't know, I'm not a neuroscientist, I didn't study plaque formation in the brain, but the way that the studies were done seem rational, logical to me. And so yeah, hold on to your seats, because that might be another revolution in science. So the question is, if I can paraphrase, introducing organisms one at a time into the gut may or may not represent reality, and may not give you an accurate reflection of their true biological significance as part of this complex community. Okay? So, yes, that is absolutely true, and there's very little experimental ways around that. What I can say is that if you went to Hyalite with your grass seed and burn it, and then threw your grass seed out, it would take hold, probably. So in the germ-free gut, there's nothing else there. No competitors, and literally almost everything that we've thrown at it will establish, with some key exceptions. One of those is really fun to talk about. It's one of the most common organisms found in all people, and it's called Faecalibacterium prausnitzii. The reason you shouldn't know that necessarily, but if you see it, Faecalibacterium is kind of a funny name. But when we throw that at a germ-free animal, it does not set up shop. We first have to colonize the mouse with E. coli, and then colonize it with Faecalibacterium. Then it does great. It takes off, it stably colonizes. These are the complex food webs that have to become established. And so in the context of those experiments, order matters and the species matter. Whether or not it provides benefit is the experimental question. If it does provide benefit, then you can be pretty sure that it's causative. If it doesn't provide benefit, you're not really sure whether it does in the context of a complex community or not. And so that would require more experimentation. But that's a really good observation.
What's the number of species in the average gut?
So the number of species comes up a lot. And I did want to mention this earlier. And the question is, how many species are in the gut? And so we only know estimates. You cannot culture everything. The gold standard microbiology is cultured on a plate, count the colonies, quantify. The reason that they're estimates is because we only can tell what is there based on their DNA and whether we can sequence it. Okay, so we're very, very good now at sequencing DNA. So we get a sample, get all the DNA, try to sequence it. The problem is we don't sequence all of it, and we miss a lot of the rare members. The other part is we're just learning, people like me, microbiologists, are learning how to DNA sequence as our careers go. So the first estimates were like 10,000 species. That has come down now. The best estimates right now are somewhere around 200 species. So, but I should say, microbes are not giraffes. Okay, take anything away from microbiology.
Whoa,
we are very good at saying a giraffe is not a lion, is not a hyena. We go out and we observe. We observe with our senses. Taste, touch, hearing, smell, that's the senses. You can't sense microbes unless you smell them. But even then, you're smelling all of them, not one of them. Our senses do not differentiate between microbes for two reasons. One, we can't sense them. They're hard to look at. They're hard to observe. But number two, they are not what we're used to saying is an organism. Imagine this, you're a microbe, you're walking around, and you see a piece of DNA on the sidewalk. If you touch it, that DNA is now in your genome. That's what microbes do each and every day. They can pick up genetic material, incorporate it into their microbiome, or sorry, their genome, and now they have the ability to fly, okay, when they could only walk. These are good. This is real. I'm not making this up. I'm making all this stuff up. But I'm not making this one up.
Okay, I'm thinking of your way. I think we had enough.
But what that does is just these genetic traits go so fast and homogenize things that when we say this species of bacteria, we don't even know what that means. When the first three E. coli genomes were sequenced, they shared less than 40% of their genes. Wrap your head around that. We're 97-98% similar to primates, to chimps. The first three E. coli strains shared less than 40% of their genes, not 97% similarity, right? So this is the complexity that we are dealing with in the microbial world.
So the question was, in your title, you mentioned the brain, the gut, and the liver, and I was about ready to think, nobody's asking about the liver. Well, the liver, so you all have heard about the really cold snap over in
Minnesota.
Okay. Yeah. So how do you stay warm? Something is giving you energy, heat, right? So what's the powerhouse of generating heat? Like if you go to Montana State University and you go to your building and it's heated, who's creating the heat? It's your liver. So it turns out, and that's exactly how we start. Because I said to Francis, Francis said, you know, I changed that gene in the brain and in the neurons, and it's got, you know, all these weird things happening. I said, we need to look in the liver. She said, you're not listening to me. I'm not going to listen to my colleagues. But I said, President, I listened to you. She said, no, you didn't. I told you I deleted the gene in the brain. I said, I know, but I bet it's affecting your liver. So what's happening is we're talking about trying to restore this energetic balance. And we're thinking that it's happening at the liver level, because the liver is the one that kind of regulates your blood glucose level. It can regulate all kinds of things that happen. The one thing we wanted to also say is, as excited as we are about the science, we're also excited because we have amazing young people working with us. You know, we have graduate students, we have staff members, we have undergrads, and what we are, so to be honest, Francis thinks we're going to cure the disease. I'm not so sure, but what I know we're going to do is we're going to instill its passion into discovery and trying to do something that we think is really interesting.